So the only thing different about this session is that we're going to chant the song of the stages of the path at the end, just to finish off, bring us up to 5 o'clock. Well, it feels like we're making a bit of progress. I don't know if that's how you feel. But if you're a bit lost or anything, please say so. You know, if you want us to sort of go over some ground again. Some things have been a bit, you know, not quite getting it or something, or any questions you have. It's our last session for the day. Okay, well, there's a little bit more about this, just finishing off that section on continuums, or continua, and then we're going to jump again. But let's read through the next paragraph then. Well then. Okay. Well then. Does such as a great aeon abide until 80 intermediate aeons have come to completion or not? So this is sort of Tibetan, or probably originally Indian ideas of time. I don't know, a great aeon. Buddha, for a bodhisattva to become a Buddha, he has to practice on the bodhisattva path for 3 countless great aeons, doesn't he? Or she, so... Maybe this is one of those great eons, anyway. I don't know, but it's certainly he's picking something that lasts for a great long time. So does such a great eon abide until 80 intermediate eons have come to completion or not? So this is the opponent challenging. If it does not abide, then that is contradictory with a year abiding until 12 months are complete. If it does abide, if a great aeon does abide until 80 intermediate aeons have come to completion, then that is contradictory with it being an impermanent, which does not abide for more than a moment, since it abides for an interval of 80 intermediate aeons without disintegrating. So somebody's got a puzzle, not quite understanding our system, you see. So he thinks, if you say it doesn't abide, then but you've just said a year abides for 12 months. But if you're saying the greater aeon does abide until 80 intermediate aeons are finished, then how can you say it's an impermanent thing which doesn't abide for more than a moment? So that's a challenge. So our answer, if we think like that, on this point, Aryadeva says, so this main disciple of Nagarjuna, while false views on continua persist, they're permanent, you'll say. While false views on collections too persist, they're real things, you'll say. Yeah, so he's bringing in generalities, you know, collections of things. But we don't need to worry about that necessarily. False views on continua is saying that if we do not know how to posit them as having parts, then the danger is that we will mistake them to be permanent. As it says, there does appear to be the fault of not knowing how to posit continua as having parts, so we will explain a little. So under two headings. A, the actual way to posit continua as having parts. Supplementary to that, the mode of positing generalities as having parts. You see, so there's a real objections from people who are maybe other Indian systems, you know, the non-Buddhist Indian systems. So they do take a different view on these things. So they're saying, look, you've got a tree, and in the spring it has nice green little shoots, nice green pretty leaves on it. Then in the summer it has, you know, dark green, glossy, big leaves. Then in the autumn the leaves turn red and or yellow, and start to fade, look completely different. And then in the winter, it's all bare branches, you know? So, obviously, that's a manifestation of change and so forth, transformation. But you've got something that's there in the spring, there in the summer, there in the autumn, and there in the winter, and that's the tree. So the tree is permanent, you see. That's what somebody's arguing. So you've got to, you know, if it's the same tree, just a tree in your garden like that, you know, then the tree actually is permanent, because whether it's green or, you know, the leaves are dark green, or whether it's got yellow leaves, or whether it's, you know, broken branch, or, you know, it's grown a new branch, still the tree, right? So the moments, you know, they can say the one moment follows another, so they're transforming. But the tree itself is permanent. This tree, you know, the tree in your garden. So the continuum is permanent, but the parts of the continuum, they can be, you know, passing away. But you've got to maintain, the thing's got to maintain an identity through time. So how can it do that unless there is something underneath it all, you know, which is unchanging? So isn't that a good argument? How would you know it's the same tree unless there was something about it, you know, that's permanent? So that's always their argument against the Buddhists. You know, they say the self is permanent. They say the self, Atman, you know, their self is permanent. So you know, your body changes. You know, first of all, you're a little girl, then you're an old lady, and then you're born as a rat, and then you're born as a god in the desire realm, and then you're born into a female body, and then you're born as a horse. You know, so all your temporary manifestations are changing, but then you've got this permanent self which abides. Otherwise, how could you, in that life as you were a horse, how could you experience the karma which you collected when you were, you know, three lifetimes ago, when you were a mouse? You know, because it's like, unless you've got some permanent thing there, you know, you, we won't call you Graham, because, you know, you're only Graham in one life, but you are still there in the future life. So the continuum is permanent. Yes. Yeah. Oh yes, it's the self which goes to enlightenment.
So the same self which is not changing.
Well, you'd have to ask them exactly what they mean. No, it's the Buddhist idea that doesn't make sense, because you're trying to say the self is changing any moment, so how can there be a connection between you and the self where the is supposed to be your previous life? You know? You've changed, so everything that was there in that moment has disappeared, so how can you see any connection? You know, why can't you... My karma can ripen on you, because, you know, you've got no connection with the person you're supposed to be in the past life, because you've completely changed. There's nothing permanent connecting you. No, nothing remains from that person. So why can't you just receive my karma? There's nothing remains from me in you, you know, so my karma should be able to ripen on you. So this is, you know, this is like an interesting disagreement. So what does the Genla Rinpa, the master, say? What does he choose to pick up on? Yeah, outsiders, that means non-Buddhist, yeah? Presumably he's thinking of the Indian non-Buddhist, because he's not familiar with scientists of the West, or, you know, outsiders to them usually means the non-Buddhist of India, and they don't really meet any of these people, because people, again, are born and brought up in Tibet, so the days when they interacted and had debates together are kind of over, so they're looking back at the Indian views of non-Indian Buddhist schools, the Buddhists of old were debating with. Outsiders indeed assert that continua and generalities and so forth are partless. Our own system asserts the opposite, that they have parts. If we illustrate this with a year, for instance, then it has 12 months, four parts. Since parts and part possessor, that's the whole, you know, that's the continuum, are the same entity, through the disintegration of the part, the first month, we posit the disintegration of the part possessor, the year. So if the part's if the part is disintegrating, then the part possessor, the whole, is disintegrating. Yeah. Through that reasoning, the first month also, through the disintegration of the first day, disintegrates and so forth, down to the first moment. Extending the reasoning, we establish that through the disintegration of the first moment, the part, a year, the part possessor, disintegrates. A great aeon and so forth are illustrated by that. Yeah. So if the part is changing, then the whole is changing. Yeah, so that's something that you need to sort of think about a bit, maybe. You know, but if I scratch, you know, just the top of this pot or this bowl, and then I'm scratching the bowl. Yeah. If somebody touches my finger, they touch me, and if they touch the pot, they touch the whole, surely. Touch Graham's finger, they touch Graham. So like that. If the part is disintegrating, then in some sense the whole is disintegrating. You know, so if the first moment of the tree is changing, or the tree is changing, you know, if the tree of the spring is changing into the tree of the summer, then you know the tree is changing. Tree in my garden is changing. So the continuum, or the part possessor, or the whole, or whatever you want to call it, that's changing. Is there anything there in the winter that was there in the spring? Yes, the tree. But it's only there through changing in every moment. It's only there through going through the disintegration that its parts are going through. Doesn't have to be permanent. So let's just read what he says. Thus, any functioning thing which is a continuum, merely by the disintegration of the first continuum possessing moment, disintegrates. And there is no time when a moment is not disintegrating and it abides permanently. Just as there is a part disintegrating along with the former moment, so there is a part produced along with the later moment, and so there is no severance of the continuum. The single essential of having parts altogether abandons the two extremes of permanence and severance. This is the way. So we have to accept the continuum has parts. They want to say the continuum is somehow partless and kind of existing, kind of somehow separate from the parts, you know. The parts are all changing all the time, but so the continuum, which is not changing, is like somehow has to be posited kind of on top of them, but not kind of going through what they're going through. But we say, no, that's very clumsy. That has all sorts of faults. You know, if it is permanent, then, like you say, you know, how could it ever die? You know, nothing's affecting it, right? If you're cutting off the branch of the tree, then you're hurting the part, you're affecting the part, but the whole is like permanent, that's not changing, the tree remains, you know. So how could the tree ever be destroyed if it's not affected by causes and conditions? So their way is not so in tune. And our suggestion of impermanence is closer to the way things are, if you agree, I don't know. So then the same argument comes up with generalities and particulars, you know. Generalities and instances. But perhaps we should leave that, because that's kind of just a sort of a side turn. And we want to keep on with impermanence, really. But a genuine debate between, you know, people who really try to figure these things out, and it's... Same when you come to emptiness, that radical difference between those people who want to posit a permanent self in order to, you know, assure yourself of your identity through time, but the sort of Buddhist way who are saying, no, there's nothing like that from the side of the object. How can a thing be permanent and yet perform functions? How can a thing like that be permanent and yet achieve, you know, states such as liberation? Yes, interesting. But now we go to, if you pass over a couple of pages, you come to number two, divisions. So, where we are in the outline of the text, have you got that? Divisions, here there are two, divisions by way of nature, divisions by way of establisher. So, that's coming from, you know, B, explanation of impermanence. A was the explanation of compounded things. B is the explanation of impermanence. And first we've talked about the nature of impermanence a little bit. Right, that was number one. So now we're on number two, divisions of impermanence. So division by way of nature, division by way of establisher. So division by way of nature. So there's a sutra quoted here. He just quotes two lines, birth ends in death, what comes together ends apart. But there's, don't know if it's exactly the same sutra, but the trying to get sort of a more full quotation, I found this in another text. Little difference in translation, maybe it's a slightly different sutra, I don't know. Whatever is accumulated ends up exhausted. Whatever has arisen ends up by falling down. Whoever meets will end up separating. Whatever lives will end up in death. Since life ends in death, all sentient beings will die, and so forth. In accordance with this statement, indeed, there are many divisions. The division of impermanence of death, the division of impermanence of coming apart, and so forth. So I don't know, that's maybe just different kinds or different types of impermanence. Don't know what he really means by divisions, as if one is maybe more subtle, one is more gross, I don't know. Anyway, he doesn't sort of bother with explaining more. If we condense these, we may include them in the two, gross impermanence and subtle impermanence. So that's territory we're already exploring. To illustrate how with Lajin, for instance, so Lajin is just anybody, Mr. John Smith, or I think in Sanskrit it would be Devadatta, so just the typical person, any old person. So, to illustrate how with Lajin, for instance, he is not remaining after his death, any herder, you know, cow herder, sheep herder, can ascertain with direct perception. So this is extremely gross. Subtler than that is Lajin at the time of the first moment, not remaining for a second moment. So that's your establishment time moment, I think, you know. It doesn't remain for a second moment after the time of its establishment. So Lajin at the first moment, if you look at him in the second moment, you'll find he won't be the same anymore. So that's a kind of a sort of more subtle impermanence than the impermanence of death. This is while he's still the continuum of the same type. But nevertheless, in the second moment he will be different. One was there in the first moment will not remain in the second. It'll be, a second moment will be different from the first. Well, we can say that the continuum of Lajin, the person who lives, you know, from when he's born until when he dies, well, he's there, but he's not there without changing. You see what I mean? So is Lajin there in the first moment? Yes. Is Lajin there in the second moment? Yes. So Lajin is there in both moments. But the Lajin of the first moment is not there in the second moment. You see the difference, Stuart? You get what I'm talking about?
Change.
Yeah. So you can say Lajin is there in the first moment, Lajin is there in the second moment, but it doesn't mean that Lajin has to be permanent. So Lajin of the first moment is not there in the second moment. A new Lajin, at the second moment is there. So if you realize that's a realization of impermanent. And what we're doing all the time is that we wake up in the morning, we think I'm the same person as I went to bed, you know. Or we see a friend, you know, come round And, you know, we think, oh, that's the person I saw yesterday. That's my friend, you know. So we don't think about them changing. So when there is some change, it's like, you know, it can be disconcerting and difficult to deal with. Oh, it takes a shock, you know. So, you know, if you ask us intellectually, does a person change? You know, we can say that. But unconsciously, like, we grasp at things, situations, you know. We buy a new car or something. Of course, we if intellectually know it's going to, you know, wear out or break down or, it'd be impermanent in some sense. But then when we come out of the house and see it's got scratched or something, you know, we get really upset because, you know, it's like our new car has like been ruined or something. But that's just the way of things, you know, the impermanence. If we are mindful of impermanence, we'd be able to sort of shrug our shoulders and not get so upset. Yeah. Doesn't mean we shouldn't do something about it, you know, if somebody's, you know, some way of preventing it happening and some way of, you know, putting the situation right and sorting whatever it is that needs to be sorted out. You know, it's not like we just ignore the problem. But you can deal with it in a much more, in a way where you've got equanimity in your mind, you know, instead of being all upset and hysterical. Oh, my house has got flooded, you know, as if, you know. But these things happen, and that's mindful of impermanence. You say, yeah, it's got flooded, but, you know, that's the sort of thing that can happen, you know. So you don't lose your balance of your mind, your equanimity, by knowledge of impermanence. But to realize the ultimate subtle impermanence, you've got to realize something more subtle than that. So he says in the last, the third level of impermanence here, the subtlest level, subtler than that again is his disintegrating right from the very time of the first moment. So you can say right from the very beginning of the first moment. It's like the first moment he stays the same, and then there's a jump, and the second moment is different. So that's legend of the first moment, like, stays the same, and then there's a jump, and now legend of the second moment is a bit different. Okay, you realize that there's a difference between the first and second moment, and that's good. But here he's saying, subtle impermanence, the ultimate subtle impermanence is right from the point, right from the very beginning of the first moment, there's that sheer, continuous disintegration. It's not step by step, it's just like a continual falling away. So maybe you got a little sense of that in the last moments of meditation. I don't know, you felt that you were just impermanent to that extent, did you? Just, you know, it's just like the solidity that we think we have is something that's like a, you know, it's an overlay by the mind, isn't it? If you're more keenly aware of how you are, then it's just like a complete process that's going on, isn't it? All those things that are going on to make your body and your mind, you know, just exist, survive. There's a complete sort of sense of just transience about ourselves, isn't there? And even about something even more solid than we are, like the building, like this... this building that's been here for, I don't know, 150 years, 200 years, however long. And they say, like, you know, obviously there's a brick in the wall. It's like it must be disintegrating. It must be going through the sense of the changes. You know, the substantial continuum. But in the case of the human body, it's like all the atoms in the body get completely replaced, don't they? So our body is more like a building where there's somebody continually replacing the bricks, taking out that brick and putting a new one in. You know, the way the body's disintegrating is quite, you know, amazing. Isn't that true? Somewhere it says that. I don't know. I've got it written down somewhere. Yeah.
Is born. all sort of going somewhere. It's almost as if there's a battery somewhere, like charging all of this going on, or there isn't a battery. You know, if you had a little battery-driven car with the controls, it would move and change, and it would be the battery that's like propelling. And from a Buddhist point of view, what's propelling all of this is it's not like a sort of magnetic kind of thing, is it? I don't know. And I get the feeling that emptiness has got something to do with all of this.
All comes down to emptiness. Yeah. Well, just let me read what I was going to read about my aside about the bricks. This is from Deepak Chopra. 98% of the atoms in your body were not there a year ago. So that's not true of the brick in the wall. I think the atoms are the same atoms. Okay, they're the same, but still they're changing all the time. But in the body, there's something more, radical is going on. But the atoms that are in there, they get taken away and excreted out and replaced by new ones. The skeleton that seems so solid was not there 3 months ago. The configuration of the bone cells remains somewhat constant, but atoms of all kinds pass freely back and forth through the walls, through the cell walls. So by that means you acquire a new skeleton every 3 months. So in order for the skeleton to remain, to keep its strength or whatever, its purity or something, then it has to be like, it's like somebody's going through the wall and picking out a brick and putting a new one in, just to maintain you, So that's supposed to be a something to think about, the instability of the... Yeah, and the configuration, the DNA or something is getting the thing that replaces the one that's taken out to be almost the same, but can't quite do it, so gradually the configuration sort of, changes and becomes a bit more decrepit in spite of the best efforts.
There's something beyond that. Deepak Chopra is talking about is our natural ability to sustain our body, which... Mm. Then that's part of that. But there is something else, which is the work I do, we call it the breath of life. In some places they call it the prana, which is the life force, which is something else. And I believe that the Tibetans call it the winds of the vital forces, which is the sustaining, inner sustaining life force, which gradually leaves the body at the time of death. Mm-hmm. Whether that is connected to an all-encompassing, sustaining matrix of existence, I don't know. Because I asked about that. I asked, what is that original matrix that sustains everything? And I couldn't find anything. Nobody could give me an answer to that. But the winds of the vital forces is what sustains the body.
Well, I think, the Tibetan, pure Tibetan Buddhist, of course there are a lot of discussion of winds and so forth, but winds in the end would seem to be a very subtle type of matter. But I don't know, the dominant force, maybe that's not right to say that, but, the driving force, I think, is the evolution of mind, in my opinion, the Buddhist is getting at. So, you're born into a world where this kind of, form is found, this kind of gross form, whatever you want to call it, this kind of solid matter and lumpy matter and, a kind of obstructive matter through, where your karma is throwing you. So everything is built up in the end out of karma. So that it's not saying that the atoms, say, in the classical Buddhist presentation of earth, air, fire and water, you know, the sort of the stream of matter in the universe, you know, that obeys rules, you know, independently perhaps of what, you know, the mind is doing there. But the way the mind gets in, the way we get involved in matter, having these bodies, or we get in and involved in a world where there is, you know, very subtle matter only, not gross matter, or where there's no matter at all except for these, you know, subtle winds that the mind rides on, which may be called very subtle kind of matter. So that just depends on, you know, your level of understanding, your level of wisdom, your level of insight, your level of how much grasping you've overcome, you know, how much sort of, you know, clinging to these things as if they're pleasurable when they're not, sort of, you know, how much you realize in the end selflessness. So somehow the sort of imbalances or defective state or contaminated state or ignorant state of the mind is what, you know, drives us into the suffering realms and gets us swimming around in there, and we're thrashing around trying to find happiness, you know, so we're using up the energy we find to try and, you know, make things better for ourselves. But if we could withdraw from that, you know, understand that the self isn't something we have to grasp at, it's something that we can, you know, see as a sort of a fabrication of the mind, and understand selflessness, then there'll be peace, yeah. Then there'll be freedom from suffering. So then there'll be a state of, you know, not having to sort of go through these fluctuations of birth and death. But then, of course, if you're a Mahayanist, if you are somebody following the Bodhisattva path, you willingly get involved in order to be a benefit to others. It's not like you're withdrawing into some solitary place, you know, just for your own sort of peace and relief. You willingly sort of evolve in order to be of use to others. So you are coming back then out of sort of a sense of prayer and sense of wishing for others' happiness. Yes.
So what I'm understanding from what you're saying now is that the winds actually support the mind or the mind stream. So that's the mind stream that is the most significant.
Yeah, I think that's when you are, you know, working to get things in your favour, then, you know, it's working on your state of mind. That's what's going to, you know, lead you to enlightenment. Working on your mental states then will, you know, whatever it is, purify your winds even to make them run in the right channels or whatever, and make you, you know, that being, that enlightened being you could be. So maybe we could just read up couple more paragraphs and then stop for our final meditation. So he's posited gross impermanence, subtle impermanence, but then in the end of the paragraph he's posited three levels of impermanence. So I think that's pretty clear in that last presentation there. The subtlest one is disintegrating right from the very time of the first moment. So not after the first moment is finished, but right from when the first moment begins, you know, right in the first moment. So it's disintegrating right in the first moment and onwards. So that's the ultimate subtle impermanence. So he then comments, if merely realizing that the lajin of the first, least, briefest moment does not remain for a second moment, does not complete the mode of realizing subtle impermanence, then how will merely realizing that it doesn't remain for a second establishment time complete the mode of realizing that? It will not. So there he's going against this establishment time momentary, which somehow there's sort of this phrase has come up, but he's kind of rejecting that as the most subtle type of impermanence anyway. But it would seem that a large number of Latter-day scholars, these are Buddhist scholars, have proclaimed that as a measure of realization of that. So please analyze. So he knows he's disagreeing with some other Buddhist masters there. But anyway, that's not so important as just understanding this. Disintegrating right from the very time of the first moment. So disintegrating right from the very, you know, the very beginning of the first moment, you see. So, well, that's a query. Well, then, how can we understand disintegrating right from the very time of the first moment, then? And here there are two, scripture and reasoning. So, scriptures. The Vinaya Sutra by the sky-coloured superior. I've never heard of that one. It might be... I'm not sure of the translation there. But it's to look check up on that one. It disintegrates in that very moment, which is the moment in which it is produced. There is no abiding in the continuum of a moment. So that's quite clear. Produced in the first moment, it disintegrates in that very moment. There are many others. So then reasoning. Here there are two. Reasoning which damages and reasoning which establishes. So one reasoning which proves that, forces you to think that, you know, any produced thing, any compound of phenomena cannot be permanent, so it damages it being permanent. And reason which establishes, a reason which establishes anything which is a compounded thing is impermanent. But maybe we should stop there, otherwise we don't have time for our meditation. So we can continue from there tomorrow. Any last question or anything else needs to be explained? So we'll try and talk a bit about the reasoning tomorrow, how that works, you know, how you have a reasoning to prove a kind of a phenomena which is a bit hidden from your ordinary sight. So that's something we can discuss. But let's leave that for now. So did you get a sense at the end of the last meditation of how even yourself was like going through that process of momentary change? Did you get that feeling coming on a little bit? People who have done meditation before might have, but others, I'm not sure. So that's the most interesting, to be able to apply it to yourself, you know, see. I'll just read a couple of paragraphs from our Sangha. Maybe he'll give us a way to think about this. It's not saying anything like too complicated. We're leaving that for tomorrow, but something that might make sense to us. So first of all, he's saying, now you've understood a little bit about gross change, impermanence of change. Now, how do we think about the subtle change? How do we go from one to the other? Having examined in this way the impermanence of change, you know, gross impermanence, using a means of reflection that is based upon direct observation, the practitioner does not recognize that the existence and the presence of physical conditioned entities is characterized by a state of disintegration in which those entities arise and pass away each moment. See, so we've seen, you know, these conditioned entities, compound of phenomena, you know, coming to an end, like when the pot gets smashed or, you know, when the kind of flame goes out. But we haven't realized how they arise and pass away each moment. So that's what he wants us to realize. Concerning this matter, he or she should make an inference that is based upon the reflection that relies upon direct observation. So you've got to go from your direct observation to your reasoning. That's your inference. And he or she should form this inference in the following manner. The change that these conditioned entities undergo over time is reasonable only if they are subject to a form of disintegration in which they arise and pass away with each moment. So if you have any kind of, you know, disintegration over time, doesn't it mean that actually you've got to have disintegration, you know, from moment to moment? this phenomena, the phenomena of, gross change, is not reasonable if entities remain in an unchanging state. Therefore, while momentary conditioned entities come into being when certain specific conditions are present, those entities that have arisen of their own accord and independently of some cause that would be necessary... Oh, sorry, I missed that. Those entities that have arisen disintegrate of their own accord and independently of some cause that would be necessary to bring about their destruction. So he's saying that, this disintegration of phenomena is something that they're born with. Yeah, okay, if you want to, you can take a hammer and smash the pot, yeah? You can bring it to its final end. But you'll find when you, if you think about it, then the disintegration of the pot is just going on all the time anyway. It's always falling away from what it is. And that isn't, that doesn't come about from any special cause, except it's made that way. And anything that's produced from causes and conditions is produced that way. So you think about the last moment of the flame, It arises and immediately passes away into its effect. So everything's doing that. It's just that we don't see it because the effect is pretty similar to the cause. The second moment of pot is pretty similar to the first moment. But in fact, the pot is just being like the flame. Yeah? As soon as it's arisen, immediately then it passes away into its effect. There's no time of, little stability and staticness at all. So we try to meditate a bit like that. 15 minutes. So just calming meditation, just meditate on the breath, for instance. Straighten your back and relax your muscles that you don't need to keep your posture. Relax your, tension in your face or your mouth or jaw. And just meditate on some plain, simple object like your breath for just a few breaths. So let's take refuge and explore Buddha's message with some faith that it's inside, which leads to freedom from suffering. We may not be fully convinced of that, but maybe we are. Maybe we trust. Maybe we found that this method has something to offer. So, relying on the Buddha's word, relying on his teaching, try to follow the meaning of it. So the Buddha blesses us to endeavor to do that. So for all those of us who are suffering, for all of those who are in samsara and have those limitations, may I quickly achieve some taste of this wisdom in order that I may benefit these beings as much as I can. So the Buddha's joyful energy is abundant and purifies our hindrances, ripens up our good potentials. So now when we see something that is undergoing change, let's say we cut a flower in the garden, we stick it in a vase, kitchen sink, but it doesn't take up the water, something like it's not the right kind of flower, or it's it just doesn't sort of remain healthy and colourful, but it starts to wither. So we don't actually see it just withering away exactly with just by watching it. But when we keep coming back to the kitchen after half a day, or we've been out to work and we come back in the evening, we get up in the morning, we see each time the flowers drooped a little more. So the leaves have lost their sort of waxy colour, the healthy sheen, and they start to shrivel, and the stem is weakened, so the stem of the flower is starting to make more and more of a curve downwards. And the petals are kind of starting to go brown at the edges, or become sort of too loose and open. So then we can ask ourselves, we're seeing some sort of manifest type of change, but how's that change happening? Is it happening in sudden jerks, in sudden steps? When we're out of the room, it kind of radically changes from being upright to be sort of half drooped? Or is it the case that, in each moment, in each interval, in each sort of continuum of time, then the flower is losing some of its strength, losing some of his colour? So isn't it a case then that actually it's more plausible, you know, more sensible to say that those changes are going on in a very gradual, sort of, you know, continuous manner. It's not that when we go out of the room it suddenly jerks down and loses its strength, for, you know, in one go or anything like that, or in steps. It's just a gradual falling away that's continuous. And if we think back to the butter lamp, isn't it rather the same? So that as soon as anything is produced there, it just immediately vanishes away, immediately changes into something else. As soon as the flame is produced, it changes. It becomes smoke. The flame continues, but it's another moment of flame from another moment of fuel. So that's it's not like the one moment of flame becomes the second moment of flame. The first moment of flame just lives for a moment and dies, and perhaps it vanishes into the smoke. So isn't that true of the stem of your daffodil or your flower? You know, the withering away. It's exactly, it's in fact just the same case where there's nothing produced but what it doesn't just fall away from itself. It doesn't need, you know, frost to come along. It doesn't need, you know, it to be too hot, or it doesn't need to have extra water. Those will influence what changes take place, but the flower will just go on changing anyway, because it's produced. Anything that's produced will just go through one change after another continuously. So let's just turn our attention to ourselves again now. So using those examples, try to get a fine sense of our own transience, our own passing away in every moment. It's not some extra cause that's forcing us to change. It's just in the very nature of being born, the very nature of being produced, that kind of unceasing change should go on. So let's dedicate our merits then. All the positive actions we've done today, dedicate the merit to the enlightenment of all sentient beings. May I become enlightened for the sake of all. Dedicate the merits to any who are really especially suffering, any near and dear ones. Dedicate the merits, of course, to the long lives of the teachers and to something good for Tibet in this continuing crisis. Thanks very much. Do we have time to recite this? If everybody has to rush off exactly at 5, then please make your way. But it'd be nice to finish this off with this reminder of the stages of the path. Song of the stages of the path. Before the Shakya Lord I bow my head, your form from hosts of perfect virtues born, your speech fulfills the hopes of boundless beings, your mind sees as they are all knowables. Maitreya Manju Ghosh, I bow to you, our peerless teachers, former spiritual sons, the task of all our conqueror's deeds assumed. You emanate in play to countless realms. A Naga, Juna, Sangha's feet I bow, Earth's ornaments renowned throughout three worlds. You show just as it is the intention of the mother of the conqueror's heart to sound. Atisha, homage, treasurer who holds the full and flawless fifth instructions for the path of the profound view and vast deeds passed down well by the two great charioteers. I bow to you, my teachers, with respect. I sing all endless scriptures moved by love. With skillful deeds you show the fortunate, the best approach which leads to liberty. Of all earth's learned ones crown ornaments, their fame a banner shining forth for beings, from Nagarjuna Sangha down in line. This graded part of Buddhahood has passed. It yields all creatures' wishes without fail, a prized instruction like a powerful king, collecting myriad streams of splendid texts, an ocean too of glorious eloquence. Know all his speeches contradiction-free, all scriptures see as personal advice. The intention of the conqueror find we these, safe from the chasm of the great mistake. So who with sense will not be captured by the three beings' great as past supreme advice? Adhere to by the many fortunate, the learned ones of India and Tibet. For certain to explain or hear but once, this essence brief of scriptures all accrues, vast benefit of teaching listening to true Dharma, contemplate its meaning. Correct and strong reliance in thought and deed upon a spiritual guide who shows the path, know is the root cause well propitious for all excellence of this and future lives. Though life may be the cost, delight him with the offering of doing what he says. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. Far finer than a wish-fulfilling gem, this life with leisure found, but now this once, so hard to find, soon lost, a lightning flash. Reflecting in this fashion, realized well, all worldly deeds are but as winnowed chaff. So always sees its essence day and night. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. Not sure death brings no birth in evil realms. Convince a triple gem relieves that fear. Take steadfast refuge, precepts untransgressed. And also it depends on this thing well, on actions black and white and their effects. Then do or cast aside as should be done. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. Form well and out to win the highest path. Till that is found, there's no progressing far. Train in its causes, nothing incomplete. Its vital threadle soiled with wrongdoing stains. Be cleansed not least of karmic hindrances. Be always keen to use the full four paths. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. Unless you strive to know true suffering's faults, no genuine urge for freedom grows thing too. On origin, samsara's causal stage, if not, you won't know how to cut its root. So then despair of and renounce the world, all keen to know what binds you to the round. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. Awakening mind, a great way center post, support and base for mighty waves of deeds. Elixir making both collections gold, a merit all of countless virtues must. The hero conqueror children, knowing this, make that most precious mind their inmost bond. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. The wishing jewel of giving grants beings hopes, fine blade that cuts the knot of meanness through. This conqueror children's deed is source and base of dauntless courage, far resounding fame. The wise ones, knowing this, the good partake of giving body, wealth, and virtues all. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. Its waters cleanse away misconduct stains. Its moon rays soothe afflictions, fever pangs. Superb like mirror amidst a myriad beings, who all bow down to that no power can daunt. Morality, the noble, knowing this, adopt it well and guard it like their eyes. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. Forbearance, best adornment of the strong, the perfect means to bear affliction's sting. Garuda to the snake of hate opposed, strong arm against the weapon of harsh words. So knowing this, be trained in always in the armor of forbearance unsurpassed. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. Attired with steady, ceaseless diligence, your insights and your scriptural knowledge grow. Wax like the moon, your acts all purposeful. Whatever work succeeds as you intend. The conqueror children, knowing this cut off, all laziness with forceful diligence. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. Then concentration sovereign o'er the mind, when placed like Meru, never wavering, sent forth it takes of virtuous objects all, to body and mind great bliss suppliancy brings. Great yogis, knowing this, resort to it, to quell the foe destruction at all times. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. and wisdom, I sing suchness most profound. Path to extract samsara's very root, the source of excellence in scripture praised, most famed of lamps to lift confusion's gloom. The wise who yearn for freedom, knowing this, with every effort generate that path. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. One-pointed concentration by itself, we don't see how can cut samsara's root, nor wisdom lacking calm abiding's path. Dispel afflictions much though it may probe, so mount the wisdom settling how things are, upon unwavering calm abiding steed. Wide wisdom then probe well with its sharp sword, of reason's middle way beyond extremes. Destroy all objects of extremist views, and so make insight into suchness vast. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. With concentration from what need to say, one-pointed focus plus discernment that precisely probes the concentration grows, that's fixed unwavering on the mode of being. Amazing who sing this strive to achieve, united calm abiding and insight. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. Praise those who dual voidness cultivate, in equipoise the space like voidness and post meditation the illusion like, by wisdom joined with method then perfect, the conqueror children's deeds, the fortune art. Sing this, don't rest content with partial paths. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. Supreme great vehicle, paths, cause, and defect, both need the common path that practiced well. Safe guidance from an expert pilot take, and sail the tantra sets vast ocean o'er. Heed all the pith advice make meaningful the leisure and endowments you've obtained. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. In order to acquaint my mind with it and serve those others with good fortune too, I have explained in plain and simple words the whole path pleasing to the conquerors. Pray all my greatest by this virtue be not parted from the excellent pure path. I too, a yogi, made prayers in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, make the same. Thank you very much. That's tired us all out, has it? Hope to see you tomorrow. Same time tomorrow. One more effort. Thanks very much.